The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning, you're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We have the Best of the Book Nook coming up for you, and this morning we're going to revisit an interview that I did back in 2003, one of those timeless interviews. Do you love animals? Do you believe that they have feelings? Well, if you do, don't miss this interview. Back in 2003, I talked to Kristen von Kreisler, a wonderful book called For Bee, the story of the beagle that changed my life. And this is a timeless interview. If you love animals, and especially dogs, stay tuned. That's coming up following the news. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 2003, I did my only interview with Kristen von Kreisler. She had a book out called For Bee, the story of the beagle that changed my life. And this is a wonderful book, and I love this interview. And it's one of those evergreens. I think I could have recorded this yesterday, and it would still sound completely fresh. Let's listen now to Kristen von Kreisler on the Best of the Book Nook.
I've tracked down Kristen von Kreisler, and she joins us by telephone from the West Coast. Welcome to the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis. Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Vic.
Kristen, you've written a book called For Bee, the story of the beagle who changed my life.
Right.
What an amazing story. Let's talk a little bit about your earlier work and then segue into this one. You wrote a book called The Compassion of Animals.
Yes, uh-huh.
What brought you to the point where you wanted to write that?
Well, let me think. It goes back to what's in the book that we're going to talk about. But I hurt my back very, very badly, and I spent 8 months lying on my sofa with my beagle cuddled up next to me. And I thought, you know, I love animals so much. Why am I not writing about them? And why am I frittering my life away writing about things that don't matter to me? And so I thought, well, what really matters is animals. And I was looking at this beagle who was being so kind and loving to me. And I thought, well, you know, animals are capable of kindness. And then so I started doing research and collected hundreds and hundreds of stories, examples of it, and put them all in that book.
Then you wrote a book called Beauty in the Beast.
Right.
And it sounds like maybe this was along a similar line of thinking.
Well, it is, except that it's more than just compassion. And in that book, my thesis is that animals know exactly what they're doing, and they choose their behavior just the same as we do. They're not just driven by instincts and unthinking beasts that a lot of people try to claim they are. So then I have many, many stories there of courage and loyalty and various abstract adjectives that we usually keep only for ourselves as humans, but I show how animals can be all those things as well.
My guess is Kristen von Kreisler. If I'm hearing you, you're saying you believe that animals have feelings. Don't most people believe this?
No, Vic. Oh, my goodness, no. It's a brand new thing. Anybody who loves an animal and lives with one, most people, anyway, believes that they feel things deeply. But, boy, it's a brand-new thing with the scientific community. In fact, you know, that I think there was a Newsweek article just this last week about this and how it's a whole new idea.
The new book, 4Bee, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life, has been published by Tarcher Putnam. How did Bee come into your life?
Oh, I was walking along the road in Mill Valley, California, and at night with my husband, and so we heard this rustling in the bushes, and this creature jumped out, and we couldn't even tell that it was a dog at first. So she was running around in circles and running up driveways and running back down, and we could tell that something was terribly, terribly wrong with her. and it was a dog and a beagle. So I grabbed her and brought her home and discovered that from a tattoo in her ear that she'd come from a research lab. So I kept her.
I see a parallel. We have people walking around this planet with tattoos on their wrists.
I know.
What kind of research lab was it? Did you ever find out?
No, we didn't. The only thing, well, I lived in the Bay Area, and there were many, many medical schools, excuse me, and research centers and companies all around. So I believe that she must have come from one of those. And we never knew exactly what had been done to her, except that when the vet spayed her, he said he never saw such huge arteries going to an animal's uterus as hers. So he speculated that she'd probably had hundreds of puppies, either as a breeder in a lab, or maybe she was given some drug to see what effect it would have on offspring or something like that. We don't know.
My guess is Kristen von Chrysler. What was wrong with her when you found her?
Oh, it was just the most terrible thing. She was scrawny. Her fur was dry, and she would just was desperate physically, and emotionally. That was the real clincher for us. She, if anybody came near her, she would vibrate, not just tremble the way animals do when they're frightened in the vet, but I mean, it was as if every cell in her body was in motion. And if my husband came in the room or any man came near her, she would roll on her back and urinate in submission. And so she was malnourished. She wouldn't bark. She wouldn't eat. She wouldn't drink water. She just huddled there. And I really believe it was like an example of somebody with post-traumatic stress.
Your husband, as a result, didn't really take to her right away, did he?
No, well, he didn't want to have her come home with us at all because we were in this terrible time in our lives right then. He was changing jobs and I was changing careers, and we were going to have to move. I mean, it was the last thing in the world that we should get a beagle thrust on us, especially a vibrating beagle.
The book is 4B, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life. Kristen von Chrysler wrote it. She joins us in the Book Nook today. B had all these problems, and I'm wondering, how did she get that way?
Well, you know, I believe that she's pretty typical. Since I've had her in my life, I've known a lot of beagle rescue groups, and they get lab beagles often, and apparently B, the way she was, is not unusual at all. And I think they're just traumatized. I mean, it's as simple as that they are isolated in tiny cages, and they never know what's going to happen to them, and they don't have any way to fight it if it does. So they just end up coming out just absolutely terrified of life and everything else.
I've heard of greyhound rescue, but beagle rescue, that's new to me. Why are there so many beagles that need to be rescued?
Oh, yeah, Vic, there are rescues for every kind of breed in the world that you can think of. If you look on the Internet, there are Basset rescues, Dachshund rescues, Golden Retriever rescues, anything.
What are they being rescued from? Just bad care?
Yeah, well, sometimes that.
Homelessness?
Sometimes they're lost. Sometimes, like with beagles, what the good news is sometimes labs turn beagles over to beagle rescue people after they're through with them. And or the greyhounds are freed after these terrible lives racing.
Uh-huh.
So there are animals all over the world that need to be rescued desperately, and thank goodness there are people trying to do it.
Okay, B comes into your life. It's not a good time for her to show up. You still decided to keep her and to try to help her, and you gave her what I felt was unconditional love, and it took a really long time, but you finally started to notice some positive changes in B. Tell us what happened.
Oh, well, we had this, what I called the three-pronged attack to try to get her to be a normal dog. That was our goal, that she would be as loving as we thought maybe she could be. So we got her on this really strict routine so that life would be predictable for her instead of just chronically frightening. And so we'd feed her at the same time every day, and we'd take her out and put her in the sun on the patio at exactly the same time. And So she got better and not so scared, and then we tried to socialize her. We took her out to meet people and had people pet her, which was hard because she'd start to vibrate, and they, you know, people were very reluctant to touch a vibrating beagle. So I took her around to so that she'd learn. She'd never been out of a cage, so I taught her what grass was and what sunshine was, and walking on sand and gravel and asphalt and all these different experiences for her. And then there were endless efforts to house train her. That took a long time. And my main thing was to try to get through to her what love was. So I would hold her in my lap, and she'd just jump off immediately and run as far away from me as she could get. So I kept picking her up and picking her up, and to no success at all. And then suddenly one day, it was like she forgot to jump off. And then pretty soon she leaned against me, and it was, remember when Annie Sullivan wrote Water in Helen Keller's hand over and over again?
Uh-huh.
And she finally understood.
Yep.
And so it was the same with B. It was like, oh, this is what you're trying to do, and this is what love is. And she leaned against me, and the floodgates opened, and it was just the greatest thing, and she was loving for the rest of her life.
You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to the year 2003, my interview with Kristen von Kreisler for her book, 4B, The Story of the Beagle That Changed My Life. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO. Southwest Ohio's musical home for joy, contemplation, and community. And we'll continue with the best of the Book Nook, but first, this message. The best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, revisiting an interview I did back in 2003 with Kristen von Kreisler for her book, 4B, The Story of the Beagle That Changed My Life.
We find in the case of our particular species that humans, individuals who were not loved when they were young, quite often turn out to be very damaged. Do you think that Bee never was loved until you came along?
Oh, no doubt about it. Not only was she not loved, I think she was drastically abused. At best, it would be indifference toward her, but I think it was far worse than that.
Hmm.
And I rescue animals pretty regularly, and I think it's like people. When you bring them into your life and love them, then they can just blossom. You know, things that are hidden away come out of them, and the capacity for love, I think, is dormant in everyone, even if it's not brought out.
My guest is Kristen von Kreisler. The book is 4B, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life. She joins us in the Book Nook today. Eventually, she began to understand what love was, and at that point, you were bonded with her, but your husband started coming along too, didn't he?
Yeah, it took a while. It took a while. He was so busy starting this new job, but little by little, he's a very, very loving man and very kind, and so being this dear little creature, she just weaseled her way into his heart.
Uh-huh. You have a picture of her on the cover of the book, and I'm guessing this was taken later in life because she's all white. She looks like just an all-white beagle.
Yes.
She's got these sweet eyes. Beagles are really a unique breed, aren't they?
Oh, they really are, and people wouldn't even know that she was a beagle after she turned white. It was an amazing thing, and everyone kept saying, oh, she looks like an angel, because she was so white that she would sort of shine, her fur would. And there was some, she was so loving, and everybody picked that up right away. And so people always thought, well, she was just an angel in white robes.
As a reader, we just assume that because of her incontinence problems and her house breaking problems that she probably never would learn how to function properly in a household.
Right.
But by some miracle, when you moved, something seemed to move in her.
Yes, you know, it was the funniest thing. And we never, by then we'd had her for over 2 years, and we'd just given up. We just thought, well, we have to live with this beagle corralled in the kitchen. And but we came to a new house, and it was as if she finally caught on, and she went to the door and cleared her throat and asked to be let out, and we let her out, and we couldn't believe it. And so then from then on, she was hygienically civilized.
She's obviously very smart. She knew it was a new house, and she knew that she better adapt to that.
Yes, and contribute to the family harmony. That's what we needed.
She also began to fall in love with various foods. And for those of us who know dogs who love biscuits, she really fell in love with certain foods, didn't she?
Oh, she did. And we'd have to spell out biscuit, B-I-S-C-U-I-T, because she would get so hysterical. You know, she wanted one so badly. And then she got so portly that we had to put her on a diet. And we fed her vegetables, and she really loved very crisp iceberg lettuce and carrots and zucchini. And so she became so enamored with vegetables that we planted a garden. And silly us, we thought everything would grow just fine. And we went out one day, and the lettuce was chewed down to a nub. So we just turned the garden over to her.
Well, that was one of my favorite parts of the story, because there was an element of humor. For her health, you wanted to try to help her reduce her size. She'd gotten rather portly.
And yes.
When you started withholding some of her favorite foods from her, she started eating all kinds of other things, including, didn't she eat like the part of a carpet?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that. Oh, Vic, that was one of the worst moments of my life. We came home from one evening, and so she was running around the house. Just something terrible was wrong. And then we went and we saw that she just devoured this rubber pad under an oriental rug. So it had stitching in it. And we rushed her to the vet, and the vet said that the stitching could gather her intestines like a fabric around the waistband of a skirt.
Mm-hmm.
So all night we thought, oh, my God, we're going to lose her. She's full of rubber and, you know, with these threads floating through. So she managed to make it through till the next day, and we took her to a special vet who, with an endoscope, went down her little gullet and pulled the pieces out. Can you imagine?
Wasn't that when you made the decision to relent a little bit on the dietary restrictions?
Right. Well, we decided we had been too pushy about it, and we thought, well, a pudgy beagle is better than no beagle at all.
Didn't she also get into her kibble one time and almost explode herself?
Yes. Yes. Actually, she did that a couple of times. She learned how to get through the, you know, those kindergartens, they call them, that hold the cabinet doors closed.
Uh-huh.
So she figured out how to open that and would nose her little way in, and twice she was there, or maybe even three times she was in the hospital with pancreatitis. So we did everything. We moved the kibble up high. We, you know, it was a constant battle.
My guest is Kristen von Kreisler. The book is 4B, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life. She joins us in the Book Nook today. And this book got my attention immediately because I saw you had an introduction by Jeffrey Musayoff-Masson, who's one of my favorite writers about animals.
Yes.
You've also got a plug on here from Susan Chernak McElroy, who we've had on this program. We've also had John Katz on recently, who gives you a plug. You had a couple of other animals in the household at the same time, which always creates a different dynamic, doesn't it?
Well, yes, and I take great pride that my animals always really love each other. I mean, it's there's a lot of love here, and so they all get along. Eventually, they do. When I bring one in, sometimes it takes a while for them to catch on to how things are, but they cuddle up and clean each other, and it's just a beautiful thing.
At the time you had Bee, I think you had a cat and another dog?
Yes, and I had a German Shepherd, Ludwig, and he was this supercilious, elegant, Tsar Nicholas of a dog. And he looked at Bee as if she were a gutter snipe at first. He just thought she was this pathetic little pauper of an urchin. And but then eventually they got to love each other very much.
When you found her, you guessed that she was perhaps 5 years old, and you ended up having her for another 15 years.
15, yes.
That's a long life for a beagle that's been through so much.
I know. The vet couldn't believe it. I mean, she was just this ancient, ancient dog at the end, and that's why when she just turned Snow White, she was probably 17 at the time, and she still lived on. And some beagles do live a long time. They're very good that way if they're taken care of.
What did you learn from her?
Oh, so much. Endless things. I learned about the miracle of healing. You know, I'd never thought much about that, and she healed so beautifully. And I learned from her about courage, because she was the bravest little dog to go through what she did, and forgiveness. You know, how we're all handed all these terrible things in our lives, usually. You know, we just sort of take turns having crises, and some people can end up being nasty and resentful and spiteful because of it, and then others can accept it and try to become loving and grow from it, and that's certainly what that beagle did. She forgave her whole past. You know, it just seemed to have gone away. And so it was like having an example in the house of how we're all supposed to be.
All over the country, and in fact all over the world, there are animals being used by researchers like Bee was to safeguard human beings from various products, to find cures for diseases, to do all kinds of things to help us as human beings. Do you think this is necessary?
Well, you know, what I decided is that a huge amount of it is absolutely not necessary. And I also believe that if we tried right now, none of it would be necessary, that there are so many alternatives. If only the researchers would use them, and if only more funding was given to develop more alternatives. You know, and there are ways to do, even if you have to use animals, there are ways to reduce the numbers that you need or to refine the techniques so that they don't suffer. So, you know, people ask me all the time, well, are you opposed to animal testing? And I think, well, or animal experiments. And I think, how can I say that when I've taken pain medications and I've been vaccinated and, you know, I've benefited? But we're in a new era now, and there's just no reason for that to have to continue.
This is a hot-button issue still, isn't it?
You bet. You bet.
What alternatives are there?
Oh, well, let's see. My favorite one is the scientists have cloned human skin. So it used to be that they'd have to burn an animal for a model of treating a burn, or they would just pour some kind of chemical on an animal's skin to see if it would corrode it, and the animal, of course, would suffer. And so now this skin, you know, they can just do it in a Petri dish. And there are all kinds of in vitro methods for testing vaccines or the toxicity of chemicals, and there are computer models, there are clinical studies. You know, instead of giving an animal an illness, you can just study people who already have it and their responses to treatments. So I get very excited by this. And another thing that I love, my almost favorite one, is that when firefighters and trauma people are learning how to do trauma training, they will force a tube down a dog's throat again and again and again. The same dog just, you know, has no way to defend itself. So now there are mannequins. Some people are using those, and of course that's better because you have a human anatomy there to study and look at. So there are many things, and there could be so many more.
Why do we continue to use millions of animals in research if there are better ways? Are there economic disincentives to change?
Well, that's what people tell me. I've interviewed a number of people, and they talk with me about how it's a whole industry for getting grants. You know, there are lots of studies on animals, and it's easier to get grants that way if you use animals because that's how it's always been done. Or there are all these businesses that manufacture restraining devices and cages and special food for lab animals and all that sort of thing. So it's like there's this big machine that's going, or the train has left the station and it's going so quickly down the tracks, and it's hard to stop it.
We have a billion-dollar industry that manufactures cigarettes, and I don't think many people would say that they're good for us, but the industry continues to thrive and grow.
I know. Isn't it crazy? And, you know, speaking of cigarettes, here's an example of how testing with animals doesn't work very well, because it's very hard to induce cancer in animals from cigarettes. And so for many years it was thought, oh, well, cigarettes don't hurt people because they didn't hurt animals. Mm. And then look what happened.
What about penicillin?
Oh, well, penicillin, it was discovered that that it would kill bacteria in a petri dish. And so then people thought, oh, well, they gave it to rabbits that were infested with bacteria. And so the rabbits, it didn't do any good. So the thinking was, well, it was of no use. So the doctor put penicillin away and didn't have it again until finally a man was about to die and nothing else had worked. So he gave him penicillin and the man perked up and he was just fine. So because of those experiments with rabbits and how the rabbit's reaction didn't translate to the same as the humans, then penicillin was delayed for many, many years.
And polio?
Polio, it's another similar interesting thing. Originally, it was thought that the polio virus, I believe, was found in human intestines or in the intestinal tract somewhere. And so, but then experiments with primates, they got it through the nasal tract. So then it was thought, oh, well, that humans must surely be the same. So there was all this fruitless line of research that went on and on and on. Trying to work with humans getting polio through their noses. And then only later they were doing autopsies of cadavers of people who had polio, and they discovered that, after all, it was in the intestinal tract. So, again, that led to a blind alley of using animals. So it delayed the vaccine.
Hmm. Kristen von Kreisler joins us. Her book is 4B, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life. And I'm guessing reactions from listeners run the whole gamut, from highly skeptical, who probably think that you're some bleeding heart crackpot. And then we have, on the other end, people who probably are saying, what can I do to help out?
Indeed. And, you know, I've never had such a response of anything I've written as this book, of people writing and thanking me for writing it and saying how much they've loved it. And, you know, Vic, a really interesting thing is that the opinions are changing. I'm not such a wild-eyed radical as you may think.
Mm-hmm.
Because one study I found that a majority of people in the United States approve using animals only if it's crucial for saving lives, and they want improved regulations for the animal's welfare, and they want the alternatives developed and used. So more and more people are feeling the same as I am.
So there's a gradual shift occurring in perception?
Absolutely. And there was a Zogby poll lately, and 51% of people in the U.S. said that they felt that primates deserve the same rights as human children. So, there is this year by year, more and more people seem to be coming to this way of thinking.
They must be tree huggers out on the West Coast.
Yeah. That's what's so sad about all of this, that it's so polarized, and they're the bunny hugger crazies and then the sadistic scientists. You know, that's how it seems to be in many people's minds. And the beautiful thing is that more and more I'm finding people trying to get the two groups talking with each other and trying to work out some kind of compromise about things.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to 2003. An interview I did with Kristen von Kreisler. Do you love animals? Have you been enjoying what she has to say about her love for animals? We'll bring you that final segment right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. A few years ago, I had Ingrid Newkirk on the program. She is the founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And during this conversation I had with Kristen von Kreisler back in 2003, we talked about organizations like PETA. Let's listen.
We have a number of organizations that are involved in various ways, and some of them are known to be rather extremist. I think People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals is almost becoming mainstream in comparison to groups like the Animal Liberation Front, which seems to give a bad name to people who want to defend the rights of animals. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, it just makes me so sad. I try so hard in my own life with my work that I do to be as temperate, I guess is the word, as I can, because I don't think offending people is going to win any friends anyway. I mean, you can never bring people over, bring people together about things if you're in their face and being too militant. So even though my heart believes so strongly, I also feel that I must respect everyone's opinion and try to be more diplomatic about it.
My guest is Kristen von Kreisler. Yesterday I had a guest in studio with a book, and at the end of the interview I showed him your book, and he said, "Oh yeah," he goes, "I know that book." And my guest was Dr. Neil Barnard.
Oh, he's wonderful.
He was right here in studio.
Did he tell you how he got involved in animal welfare?
Well, he grew up on a cattle ranch, I know.
Yes, and drove cattle to slaughter and ate steak all the time. But he fell in love. He brought a little white rat home from a lab when he was an undergraduate. And he just fell in love with this rat and played with it. And her, I believe it was female. And so then the rat got cancer and was just so obviously suffering. And he realized suddenly that if a little white rat could suffer, all animals could suffer. And then look at what he became, this marvelous man working for animal welfare.
He's never told me about the rat.
Yes, he told me. I interviewed him.
I've had him on this program a half a dozen times. He's never mentioned the rat.
Oh, well, ask him about it. He's one of my heroes in the animal welfare movement. I think he's a fabulous person.
Well, he was here yesterday to talk about diet.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a new book out about foods that are seductive, like chocolate and things like that. But I think his message is still there. The animal message is still in his books.
Yes, and he's the one who's responsible for so many of the medical schools in the U.S. Stopping using animals in the beginning labs, because when he was in medical school, he refused to take this dog that was issued to him and give it all kinds of drugs and observe it and then kill it. And he went to the library to do the research instead. And so then more and more students followed his example, and then he started the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and then now way over half the medical schools have stopped that.
And at one time, Kristen, you had aspirations to be a biologist. What happened?
Well, I was not made for that. I took the lab. I loved biology. I loved the animals and the stars and the plants and all the things we were studying. But in the lab, we were issued a prenatal pig to dissect. And fortunately, my lab partner had gone to mortician school, so he was pretty hardened about these things. But I could not touch this little pig. I would walk out of the class with my head spinning sometimes, just almost physically sick. So I knew I could never be a biologist, that was just not something I was going to be able to do. And it was right, because I'm much too sensitive toward animals. I could never be a vet either, as much as I wish that I could be.
My guest is Kristen von Kreisler. Her book is 4B, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life. What's the bottom line? Why did you write this book?
Well, I wanted to, it's sort of a tribute. I wanted to write a really, really beautiful story about an animal who had so dramatically changed my life. She gave me my vocation and my work as a writer. Everything is because of her. And so I wanted to do that, and I also was hoping that people would fall in love with her, which apparently seems to be happening a lot, and that they would just realize that this beautiful creature that could suffer, you know, and by extrapolation, all lab animals can suffer, and they deserve kindness and respect, you know, that's what I'm hoping, that in a larger sense, that people will come to that conclusion.
Kristen von Kreisler is our guest today. She joins us by telephone from the Pacific Northwest. I see you're involved with an organization called In Defense of Animals. What do they do?
Well, I haven't been so involved lately, but, oh, this might interest you. The thing I was doing with them, Jeffrey Mason, whom you like so much, he and I were co-chair of a campaign that they had. It was called They Are Not Our Property, We Are Not Their Owners. And the idea is to change the thinking of people that animals are not just objects to be owned and disposed of and used in any way we want, that they deserve our respect and they deserve to have rights of their own. And So that's even the use of the word owner, you know, that's another thing. And that's kind of a controversial issue.
Hmm.
A lot of people think, oh, that's just silly. And I really don't, because it's a subconscious thing. And it implies to people that they own this animal, which who can own anything? I even think, how do we even say we own the property where our house is? You know, we just are passing through in this life, and I think we're all equally on the earth together.
But you know, we did discover America.
That's true. Do we own it? What do you think, Vic?
What we do now, yeah.
Yes. I guess,
yeah,
for now.
I'm just teasing you.
No, I know.
My guest is Kristen von Kreisler. That sounds like an organization that Jeffrey would be involved with. Is he still living in New Zealand?
Yes, uh-huh, sure is.
We had him in studio last year, and he's really an amazing guy. And his whole story of living in New Zealand, what a wild man.
Yeah, no, he really goes by his convictions and is a very, I'm very, very fond of him. He's very bright and a very kind person.
You're a freelance writer?
No longer.
I've
stopped. I was a college or university English teacher and a freelance writer for many magazines. And then I've been so happy doing what I'm doing now and trying to, with books, to show people how good animals can be and how they deserve love and respect, that that's really pretty much taken over my life.
What are you working on?
Well, right now, my book has been orphaned at the publisher, meaning that my editor was laid off and the publicist was transferred. So I'm absolutely up to my ears in promotion for this book. I can't even think about what I'm going to do next.
Are you saying this book was orphaned?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you mean by that? How does this happen? Was this cutbacks at the publisher?
Yes, uh-huh. And so the people in the publishing that were supporting the book are no longer there to do it, and so I'm the only one, and I was determined that this book would not die. I mean, I care so much about B and about what I was writing about.
So you're doing your own publicity campaign?
Mm-hmm. I've been doing it, and it's been a marvelous experience because I've surely learned a lot.
Well, you got on this program, and as people know throughout the country, this is the toughest program to get on.
Well, boy, am I honored.
I'm teasing you again.
I know, and it's fine.
We try to be picky, though, and I literally am getting 50 book pitches a day, so if you can get through that gauntlet, that's 250 a week.
Right.
And,
oh, well,
and that... we only do about 150 interviews a year, so.
Oh, well, I'm so pleased, Vic. Thank you.
I wasn't putting you off. I know we went round and round about booking this interview.
Well, I'm so persistent, and I hope I didn't put you off, but I'm so committed to what I'm doing that I will, you know, go to my death doing it.
You are persnickety. I mean persistent.
Persistent. Well, it paid off, because here I am.
Yeah. I see you've got some endorsements from some actresses.
Yes.
Rue McClanahan, Mary Tyler Moore, and Betty White.
And Bea Arthur, the three Golden Girls. Isn't that an amazing thing?
All three of them.
All three. They're all animal welfare people, and I didn't know them. They may not even know that they've all endorsed it.
Mm.
And Mary Tyler Moore read the book and loved Bea so much that she called me up and asked me to help her get involved in working for lab animals.
When you were young, did you feel the same way about animals, or has this been a gradual shift for you?
No. My goodness, Vic, I was born like just this quivering mass of sensitivity toward animals. let's see, what can I say? I was born on St. Francis's feast day, and October 4th, and that should have told me early on, but even as a child, I never made it through Bambi, you know, when the forest fire and all the animals are running for their lives. And I got completely hysterical, and my parents had to take me home. And in Western movies, when they would jab the spurs into the horse's side, and I would wail and cry and have to be taken to the lobby.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's in me, and it took me a long time to realize that I was that sensitive for a reason, you know, and I believe that we're given our characteristics in life to use in a positive way, and so that's what I'm trying to do. It took me a while to figure out that I should be working for animals.
In the book, you mentioned Bambi. You also mentioned going to a place called the Varsity Theater, and that struck me because I saw Bambi at the Varsity Theater. What city was that?
In Austin, Texas.
Oh, it must have been a common name once
Where
upon
were
a
you?
Time. I was in Des Moines.
Oh, Des Moines, yeah, yeah. Oh, I'll never forget it. And the seats with this sort of ribbed corduroy stuff, you know, that I even remember where I was sitting in the theater at that movie.
I'm going to guess the Varsity was close to the university.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Because our Varsity was right across the street from Drake University. I think that was kind of a collegiate name.
Probably so, yeah. Right. And my father was a professor at the University of Texas, so we would go all the time to movies, you know, right there after his classes and things.
I'll bet Austin was really quite a town in those days.
Oh, my. I think the population was 50,000.
Oh, wow.
Or even less. It was just a tiny little university town, and it was a great way to grow up, I'll tell you. A very protected, safe place to be.
My guest is Kristin von Kreisler. Her book is 4B, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life. Is there a website or anything that folks could go to? Do you have anything like that?
Well, it's KristinVonKreisler.com, and I've got to change the name because who can spell Kristin von Kreisler?
Well, if any of our listeners have a question, they can send me an email, and I'll spell it for them.
Right, that's great. And then 4B is on Amazon. If you go there, then you can see how it's spelled, how to spell my name, and then get to the website that way, I guess.
Okay. Well, we really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much, Vic. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Kristin von Kreisler. The book is 4B, The Story of the Beagle Who Changed My Life. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. As always, thanks for listening. And that was Kristin von Kreisler, recorded back in 2003. And it was very interesting. She was a persistent person. That's the only interview I ever did with her. And back in those days, the publishing industry was already beginning to consolidate. And as she mentioned during that interview, her book had been orphaned. Her editor at her publishing house and the publicist had both moved or lost their jobs. I don't remember exactly what happened, but the book was orphaned. Nobody was publicizing it, so she had to do it herself. And she had been calling me and emailing me and saying, you know, I'd really like to be on your show. And it happened, and it was a great interview. I loved talking to her. And I just opened the newspaper this morning and was surprised to see that there's a big obituary in the New York Times for someone that I met once. And he's someone that you've probably heard of. We live in a day and age when we have a lot of billionaires around, but how often do you meet one? How often do you run into someone like Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos on the street? Unless you're invited to something like the Met Gala and you're wearing your fancy weirdo outfit, you're probably not going to meet people like this. Well, back in 2007, I met a billionaire, and he just died. And this has a literary connection. So let me tell you about the night I met Ted Turner. Love him, hate him, feel apathetic towards him. He was larger than life, and he just died. I just read his obituary. Ted Turner was from our region, originally from Cincinnati, before his family moved to Georgia. And back in 2007, I was at the Book Expo conference in Los Angeles. And I was with my friend Bill Young. He's a literary escort from Chicago. He knows everybody. And he always gets me in trouble. He always take me places I never expected to go. That afternoon, we left Book Expo and took a limousine ride to a restaurant where we ate lunch with Stephen Cannell, the guy who created all the TV shows like the Rockford Files. He had become a author. He was writing fiction, and we rode in his limousine and went to lunch, and then we went back to the convention center at the Staples Center in Los Angeles and hung around with all kinds of people, saw all kinds of celebrities walking around. I saw Barbara Walters and Dr. Ruth Westheimer, Alec Baldwin. Who else did I see? Jamie Lee Curtis, Ernest Borgnine,
Larry Flint. It was a real potpourri of personalities. And we ended up getting invited somewhere due to Bill's connections. Bill said, how would you like to go to Larry King's house in Beverly Hills? They're having a party for Ted Turner. And I said, well, that sounds kind of weird. So they had a chartered bus that took us from the Staples Center over to Larry King's house, where they had hundreds of people there to wait on us, valet parking and all kinds of tasty hors d'oeuvres and lots of things to drink. And he had resodded his entire lawn and planted new palm trees. And it was a party for Ted Turner's autobiography, which was just coming out. Larry King was the host. He gave a speech out by the swimming pool. And he's staying there with his very young wife. I think she's about his seventh wife. And his very young children. And he stood there and he said, well, some people have been commenting about the disparity in the age between my wife and I. And he says, if she dies, she dies. And the kids looked over at him like, Dad, what are you talking about? Well, a little bit later, after many glasses of wine, we were inside Larry King's house. And there was a giant portrait of him right by the bar. And his face was entirely made from jelly beans. And sitting beneath the portrait next to the bar, with a big box of cigars next to him, was Ted Turner, the guest of honor. And there was a woman massaging his neck. And I believe she was the former wife of a very famous author, but don't quote me. Anyway, he's just sitting there and he looks exhausted. I think he'd probably had a few drinks too. And I'm standing there in front of him. He says, hi. He says, how are you? And I said, well, great. I said, gosh, it's not every day I get to talk to a billionaire. He says, where are you from? I said, well, I cover books for the Dayton Daily News. And he says, Dayton? He says, that's where I'm from. He says, before we moved to Georgia, he says, I'm from that area. And he was very friendly. And he talked to me for about 10 minutes while she massaged his neck. And it was really kind of strange. And then reading his obituary, I realized just what an amazing figure he was. Like I say, love him or hate him, he founded the big cable station in Atlanta. He founded Cable Network News. For better or worse, he changed the way that we get the news. You remember when you just tune in for the evening news or whatever, and that was your daily dose? It wasn't a 24-hour barrage where you're reading the news, and 1 hour someone's saying, the war is over. And the next hour they're saying, we're blockading them. And the next hour they're saying, we've come to an agreement, but I can't tell you anything. And the next hour they're saying, we're going to bomb the heck out of them. And the next hour they're saying, we found peace. And the next hour, you know how the news cycle just kind of like chews you up like a tennis shoe in a dryer? I mean, it's just horrible. Anyway, thanks, Ted, for bringing us CNN 24-hour news. And if you'll recall, he was just about ready to go bankrupt when he was making a lot of these deals, but he was a risk taker. And he brought in big celebrities, including a guy named Larry King, who was on CNN all those years. The late Larry King, who was walking around his yard that night, kind of like a zombie. I didn't speak to him. Unlike Ted Turner, he did not seek me out or speak to me. And I watched him kind of walking around, and I went in his house, and there were photos on the walls of his house of just about every single celebrity you would ever want to meet or not want to meet. He was with everybody, every president, every rock star, every baseball star. Everybody had their photo taken with Larry King. And just walking around inside his house, it was a really kind of bizarre feeling. And Bill and I finally decided we'd had enough. And we got our swag bags. They'd given us these gift bags with all these goodies in them. But mysteriously, Ted Turner's book was not in the bag. And there was a big stack of them there right in the living room. And I was standing there with Bill and There was no one else around. We were getting ready to leave, and I thought, gosh, I sure would like to have a copy of Ted Turner's book. It's his autobiography. And so I filched a copy. I admit it. I swiped one. I stuck it in my swag bag. We walked out the front door. The valets said, can we go get your limo for you, sir? We said, no, 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 we're fine. And we walked down the long hill out of Beverly Hills and caught the city bus back to our hotel. And that was my experience with Ted Turner. And I got back to the hotel room, and I opened my swag bag and started looking at all my goodies. I pulled out the book by Ted Turner because I thought, well, maybe I can get an interview on my radio show with this guy. It's unlikely, but maybe. And so I opened it, and all the pages were blank. The entire, it was just a real book cover and a blank book, just white paper. There was nothing in it. I was like, okay. So I finally got to read his autobiography all these years later, 19 years later, when I read about him in his obituary in the New York Times. Ted Turner, rest in peace. He owned millions of acres of land in America. Whoa, he was a billionaire. Unbelievable that I met him. You couldn't do that today. Of course not. He's dead. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to the Book Nook, the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. It comes your way every Saturday morning. Have a good morning.